I feel happy when I open the violin case at home and I play a scale, because that's the fundamental of everything. It's major, minor. There you go. Just if you can play major properly and minor properly, three octaves with some things, I then play some Bach. And I think if I play Bach properly, I'm actually a very lucky person. That's all.
Und damit herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Ich bin Julika aus dem Team der Elbphilharmonie und ich sitze hier mit meinem Kollegen Tom. Hallo lieber Tom.
Hallo Julika.
Du hast dich diesmal ja mit dem israelisch-amerikanischen Geiger Pinchas Zuckermann getroffen. Der ist tatsächlich eine lebende Legende. Ich glaube, er ist 2023, jetzt gerade 75 Jahre alt geworden, gehört seit Jahrzehnten zu den größten Klassikstars der Welt. War ja auch hier tatsächlich schon einige Male zu Besuch. Ich muss sagen, als du meintest, du hast ihn angefragt für einen Podcast, hätte ich nicht gedacht, dass er das so zusagt, vor allem nicht so kurz vor seinem Konzert.
Ich war ehrlich gesagt auch überrascht, aber es passt total zu diesem Menschen, wie ich dann erfahren durfte, als ich ihn kennengelernt habe, weil er extrem unkompliziert ist und extrem ungestresst. Der macht diesen Beruf seit, weiß ich nicht, 50, 60 Jahren und hatte kein Problem damit, zwischen Anspielprobe und Konzert sich mit mir noch zu unterhalten. Es war sogar so, dass wir haben das oben gemacht in der Sky Lounge, weil kein anderer Raum frei war, also im 20. Stock, da muss man dann wieder runter, um auf die Bühne zu kommen. Und ich musste ihn erinnern und sagen, Maestro, ich glaube, es ist jetzt Zeit, dass Sie sich umziehen und dann ist das Konzert in der Viertelstunde. Und er so, oh ja, 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 stimmt, ja, das sollte ich vielleicht jetzt mal machen. Und dann sind wir mit dem Fahrstuhl runtergefahren durch das schon sehr belebte Foyer und in sein Künstlerzimmer und dann ist er maximal entspannt zur rechten Zeit auf der Bühne erschienen und hat fulminant das Konzert gespielt. Also
unsere Projektleitung wird dir ewig dankbar sein, dass du den auch rechtzeitig runtergebracht hast.
Ja, ich glaube, das fanden sie schon auch, damit rechnet man dann auch, dass man dann aufpasst und nicht den Künstler irgendwie auflaufen lässt.
Du hattest mir ja auch direkt danach ein Foto geschickt von euch, von der Dachterrasse oben und drunter geschrieben nach dem Gespräch mit Pinky oder so. Das sah wirklich auch schon sehr, sehr nett und vertraut aus.
Ja, ja, es war wirklich ein ganz inniges und nettes Gespräch, wobei eben der Gesprächsanteil auch schon merklich mehr bei ihm lag als bei mir, was aber auch mich nicht weiter verwundert hat, weil der Mann ist einfach durch seine Lebensleistung auch jemand, der sich mitteilt. Und man kann ihm Fragen stellen, aber das ist dann eigentlich nicht so, dass diese Fragen jetzt da ein großes Gespräch aufmachen würden. Vielleicht, wenn man sich jetzt dann doch mal eine Stunde länger noch unterhalten würde, kämen noch andere Aspekte zum Vorschein. Aber jetzt für die Zeit und auch für die Intensität fand ich das total toll, mit ihm so zu sprechen.
Interessanterweise ging es ja sehr viel um seine Ausbildung, oder?
Ja, es ging um seine, sagen wir mal, um seine Technik. Die Ausbildung ist natürlich die Voraussetzung für seine Technik. Aber die Technik, auf die hält er halt ganz, ganz große Stücke. Und ich glaube auch zu Recht, das ist, geht zurück auf diesen iranisch-russisch-französisch-amerikanischen sagenumwobenen Ivan Galamian, der eine, glaube ich, für Geiger ziemlich qualvolle Übemethode entwickelt hat, die aber ganz starke Resultate zeitigt im Hinblick auf die Artikulation. Da geht es hauptsächlich um die Bogenführung, was man wo, wie auf dem Bogen spielt, wie man die Töne artikuliert. Und das ist extrem spannend. Und ich habe auch das Gefühl, das ist eine Schule, die kann man wahrscheinlich, wenn man richtig gut ist, auch zuordnen. Man hört einen Geiger, eine Geigerin und sagt, das, wenn das jetzt nicht wenigstens Galamian beeinflusst ist, dann fresse ich einen Besen.
Ja, krass. Du meintest, das ist so ein bisschen so wie ein Turbo dazu geschaltet.
Ja, ja, ja. Es ist wirklich, der Ton ist riesig, ohne dass man irgendwie das Gefühl hätte, da wird was forciert, sondern der ist einfach aus der Natur des Spiels und aus der, wenn man, man muss sagen, aus der dressierten Natur des Geigers, der die Bogenhand so führen gelernt hat, hat das einfach diese tonische Qualität. Und das hängt auch mit der linken und der rechten Hand zusammen. Das ist alles irgendwie sehr, sehr wiegelinisch, wie wir Norddeutschen sagen. Sehr ausgefeilte Technik.
Beim Hören ahnt man so ein bisschen, dass er wahrscheinlich auch ein, zwei Sachen vormacht. Ich hatte aber den Eindruck, man kommt ganz gut durch.
Ja, man muss beim Hören, muss sich vorstellen, der Mann sitzt vor einem und er hat beide Hände frei und er zeigt dir mit der linken, mit der rechten, wie es eigentlich
so
geht.
So wie du es gerade eigentlich auch mir gegenüber nochmal gemacht hast.
Und man denkt so, ah ja, natürlich. Jetzt würde man es natürlich gerne auch noch den Podcast-Hörern so zeigen können, aber das geht nun mal nicht in dem Audioformat.
Werdet ihr euch denn wiedersehen, wenn ihr wiederkommt, jetzt wo ihr euch so
verstanden habt? Ich glaube, er kommt nächsten April wieder zum Konzert und wenn es sich irgendwie einrichten lässt, werde ich da natürlich hingehen und dann werde ich auch ganz brav mich in Erinnerung rufen oder sagen, dass ich mich freue, dass ich ihn sehe und dass es ihm hoffentlich brillant geht und dass er noch so lustig und so aufgeräumt ist, wie ich ihn erlebt habe hier.
Wer weiß, vielleicht gibt es ja dann Folge Nummer 2 mit Pinky. Wenn ihr dazu Fragen oder Anregungen habt, schreibt uns gerne an podcast@elbphilharmonie.de und damit viel Spaß beim Hören.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
I'm sitting here with the honorable, wonderful Pinkas Zukerman in the Sky Lounge of the Elbphilharmonie. And you are so cool that you just take this little break between the long rehearsal and the concert to talk to me for half an hour or so.
I'm happy to be here.
Totally wonderful. I was thinking, you are playing here with the English Chamber Orchestra, and I think your story goes back to at least 1970, if not even earlier.
Well, I first played with the orchestra in 69.
In 69.
When they were on a world tour with Daniel Barenboim.
Okay.
And he asked me to come and play the D major violoncello of Mozart in Carnegie when they were playing. And so I said, of course. And then from that moment, we still did a lot of concerts together with Daniel for a couple of years. But I kind of directed really to start with. Without him, I started directing. And then slowly I grew, first of all, as a musician. And also I got to learn more about how things work with an orchestra. Engineering, I call it, you know.
Okay.
One, two, three, but it's really more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But I did that at Juilliard when I was about just under almost 17, well, 18 actually, for about 3-4 months. I had a few classes with people that really couldn't do this at all. I mean, they could not beat 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Why wouldn't they be able to do that?
Good question. I don't know. I still am trying to figure out how the left and the right work. I know how to do that here. Mm-hmm. There's no question that you have to start with the left hemisphere to control the right. Why? It's very simple, because we hold a bow, and with the bow we make the sound. If you don't want to hold the bow, play pizzicato. That's okay. Segovia did very well, but there's ways to play pizzicato too. So True. We start really working, and this was maybe the one thing that Galamian, more than anyone I know, created as a language also, from French, from Armenian, from Russian. There are people that have done similar over the years, but not enough. And I really sit on that. I call it fundamentals. And it's a graduation of how the mind can absorb information. The practical side of knowing how to create the sound, not only in the physical way of doing it, but also in writing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean computer, I mean writing it with a pencil, very important. That repetition helps that. And I see that so much with young people when they come to us, say 19 to 24, 25, they're a mess. I mean, a mess. And what happens really most of the time, I'd say 99%, maybe more, especially boys, after about 6-7 months, the hair is combed better. And you go, And then all of a sudden the shirt will be buttoned. You know, they're not so, they prepare somehow.
Mentally.
The practical side, meaning the left side, the left hemisphere prepares the right. I've talked to neurologists about over the years, and they said, well, we can only tell you that the brain actually works both ways. But they say, if it works for you to do that, keep it up. So we do that.
But Galamian didn't tell you this. I think Galamian was more intuitive in a way, wasn't he? Or was he also into this left-right brain hemisphere
thing? He was
thing?
Intuitive because he didn't say very much.
Yeah, that's what they say.
You don't have
say.
To. You don't have to. When he said sounding point, you know what he meant.
Okay.
And that means putting the bow on the string in the middle between the bridge and the fingerboard, somewhere in the middle, is sounding point. Now you have to press down, and there's ways of pressing it down. You have to do both sides because we have two muscles.
In the forearm.
So, yeah, it's the same like on the piano.
Yeah.
You have to do that. If you can't, the same in tennis. If you just go, it doesn't work. You have to let go, release. Okay, so we call it catch. So we catch the bow on the string, catch the string, and release. Catch and, but then he started with doing this exercises, which we have, and then the point
lengthening
of being...
Lengthening the finger.
Yeah, well, the intuition comes of knowing how the person develops, and you can see that. And so if they develop fast, you just keep going, but you have to repeat again, because the brain is very slow. So... he had that intuition about every person. And every person was a little bit different for him. The language is similar, but it's the way he used it. And I promise you, he didn't use very much. We talked way too much today. The brain cannot take it all. Really, they can't. It can't. So we call it out. And then comes all of this, which is very important, because then we have levels of arm. And I always ask, how many levels do you have? And some of them would say four. I said, why four? Well, four strings. I said, hey, bravo, very good. That's the first compliment they get, because that's important. Because if you do this, oh, my goodness. If you do this, oh, goodness. Okay. When I studied in Israel with Feher, she came from the Hubei school, which was similar, not in language, but in physical production. In other words, you don't go this way, you don't go that way. And in order to get rid of that, she would say, Pinchas, du musst ein kleine Sache hier hin tun. Just a little book. So I would put the book there. Aber ich kann so nicht spielen. Moment mal. And after a couple of minutes, she'd say, okay, bingo. All of a sudden, you realize what you're doing. So there are things there that are similar. The approach is a little different. That's all. But she always said, du musst mit einem schönen Ton spielen. And that's exactly what Galamia said. You have to play with a beautiful sound. I finally realized what that meant last week. Because, you know, I always say to them, if you make a good sound and a beautiful sound at the same time, you get more money.
And you also say you don't know any single musician who does not want to make a beautiful sound.
Of course, and that's of all course we talk
it's
about.
So terribly difficult to achieve this.
Well, it's difficult, but it's not that difficult. If it's broken down systematically from, let's say, the age of 14 to 21, or 7 to 14, 14 to 21, let's say, because something takes place in the body, in the brain, in the hormonal process, and each one is a little bit different. The growth of that is very important, I think. We, of course, we study harmony and chamber music, and we do all those things that create us, well, they create an inner understanding with time. It doesn't happen in 2 years. It happens in maybe 25, maybe, that you really finally say, oh, that's it. You know, you wake up one morning, you go, holy mackerel, what the hell was I doing? Okay, so that's self-criticism in a way. But it's not. It's
healthy.
Evocation. It's a kind of a evoking idea of what the art form is, because it's complete. You know, you can look at a beautiful sunset like we're looking now. It's two, three-dimensional. Music is five-dimensional. So that's hard to comprehend. It takes time. It takes a lot and patience. Oh, my goodness. So I've been now teaching for a very long time. And one of the reasons I got interested in teaching is my father had a stroke, and he played the violin. So I was at home in Tel Aviv one time after having some lunch with my parents. I said to him in Yiddish, because he could hardly speak anything, but Yiddish he could utter a few words. I said, willst du ein bisschen spielen? I said, ich mache so, and he machte, oh, okay. So I took the fiddle out, I went behind him, and I said, come. Spielte Mendelssohn.
We have to explain this for the listeners here, because we don't see you. So you would play the bow, and he would play...
I would play the bow, and he would play the left hand.
Yeah, fantastic.
And he went, the B natural on the E string is very hard to find for anybody. All of a sudden, bingo, he was right there. Now, this man had no... He had 80% of his body was gone, this side, the right side. And I went behind him, and we played the first phrase. And he looked at me and went,
Sweet.
And all of a sudden, he started to talk a little freer. Not clear, but freer. And I thought, how can that be? That a brain is not functioning on one side, and yet one side is totally okay. Again, I've spoken to quite a few experts in brain aspiration, so to speak. And now we have 3D. The 3D can explain a lot. So...
It's metaphysical also, because, I mean, in Alzheimer's and in dementia, you have people who are pretty much gone, but music still is there.
It's amazing.
They can sing like entire songs, verses.
Not only songs, you put on, you tell a person to stand and you tell them to walk over there. And when they get to the other side, you turn them around and they play their favorite song. It could be whatever, Beatles or something, and bingo, they're running across.
See?
That's amazing. Okay, so how come that happens? You know what? They're still looking for the answer.
Sure.
And I'm sure they will look for a long time. But when we play, this was one of Galamian's great lines. He said, it sounds good. That's how I used to speak. He said, it sounds good, you feel good. And you know what?
It's the truth. Huh?
It's absolute. And I, for one, try to aim to make myself feel better forever.
That's people one of say, my questions. I mean, you're 75 now?
Almost.
Do you
no,
feel
I'm 75.
Like, do you feel like there is something getting better and better and maturing and even
I don't know.
More effortless?
I can't answer that.
You can't
I don't
that.
Know. I know what I have to do in order to make myself the same player I was
but
yesterday.
But you could say, I mean, feeling comfortable and really being happy playing, that is a measurement that you could take with yourself.
I feel happy when I open the violin case at home
beautiful.
And I play a scale. Because that's the fundamental of everything. It's major, minor. There you go. Just if you can play major properly and minor properly, three octaves with some things, I then play some Bach. And I think if I play Bach properly, I'm actually a very lucky person. That's all. And I tell you, I discovered that more than any other time in my life is when I got sick at the beginning of COVID. I had high fever. I was out for 3-4 days. And after about 10 days or so, 12 days, I began to come back. And in our bedroom, I see huge, big skyscrapers in New York. And I was sitting there and I thought to myself, Pink, you know what? Why don't you play some Bach? So I took the fiddle for the first time. It felt really kind of fresh, weak but fresh. And I started to play a little Bach, sarabande this, a little, not much, just quietly for myself. And I looked out at those incredible skyscrapers. And I thought, how can it be that in 75 or 80 years, we ruined everything. By 1945, we had nothing. And so all of a sudden, we have all of this. And how is it possible that one little bug from wherever it was, because at that time we still were, we don't have an answer to that. Yeah. How can that be? But then I thought, boy, am I lucky. Because I kept playing Bach every day. And I used to play Bach always, but it didn't have quite the same meaning. Now I play Bach all the time because it does something with the hand also. And Casals, God bless him, he always said, I play a Bach every day. I play a Bach. I had no idea what the hell he was talking. Now I know.
Cool.
So it's something inside.
It's some purification or
no,
some enrichment?
I don't put a lot of fancy words to this. No. You know, I just know how I feel. When I finish playing 15 to 20 minutes, different movements, hey, you know, pretty good. I mean, I don't play Tchaikovsky necessarily, but I play Bach very necessary because it's complete.
Yeah.
It's absolutely complete. And so when you can do that well, well, it takes about 75 years. And if I can do it for another few more and in tune, in clear sound, hey, I'm one of the luckiest person in the world.
Yeah.
To be for myself, for just myself. And I don't, you know, I don't show off. I don't play encores Bach, you know. And I will play now the Sarabande from the D minor partita. You know what? Geschlafen. What the hell? Just play it. They'll get it. Don't worry. The public's not stupid. You know, all these people make these explanations.
Yeah, they want to be polite, you know, because they know some people are probably not that knowledgeable.
Well, because we have television. We have now the systems. We have all these videos. What are we talking about? I teach on video, yes, because you can repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And at 95, I discovered video conferencing. And I am absolutely convinced that in no time, soon, very soon, we'll have satellites. We already have. Now, I don't know which one is going to be, if it's Mr. Tesla or if it's going to be another, or Mrs. Tesla. I don't know which one, but there are satellites up there that can now produce the concert, produce, I mean, transmit to many places in the world for very, very little money. And I started that from the first day I saw this. I said, 400,000 people for $1. That's it.
Yeah.
So, and it multiplies. It's 400, 800, and so on. That will save our, I think, our traditions, our history. It will give us a better understanding of other people. Because today, kids see a lot of misery. And some people will say, you got to turn it off. Okay, I agree with that. but they have to at least give them some proportion of what's beautiful in life, like a museum, or a beautiful piece of music, or a dance, and something that's not so good, like a bomb, an earthquake. I don't see anything wrong by showing a six-year-old, a five-year-old, what just happened in Korea. Mm-hmm. They're going to get to it anyhow. So why not sit with them and say, look what Earth can do. It can give you beauty and also misery. It's okay. It's called forte and piano, if you like, piano and forte. We have to have that.
It's a polarity.
Develop as people. Yeah. And I think if you do that, and you can play an instrument or sing or dance for that matter, or paint, you're going to live a long time, a lot happier, for sure. And it's nice for me to hear old friends, new friends, friends that will be, said, my God, you're 70 who? How do you do that? I said, fundamentals. That's all how can you explain that? It's very hard. But they say, just keep it up, please. I said, I'm trying. That's all I can do is play a little bit better, if I can. And the minute, I can tell you, the minute I will not play well enough, first of all, I'll know it, obviously. But I can tell you, my wife will tell me, and my kids, because my kids have great ears. And they'll say, Dad, what are you doing?
Stop.
They won't say stop.
Slowly.
No, I don't think they'll say that. No, okay. No, they're too polite.
Nice.
I will say stop to myself. And I have over the years heard some extraordinary people play really badly. And I've wanted to go and say, why don't you just stop it already? I said, you're not allowed. No. Because the art form is too deep and misunderstood a lot of times. And even if the person is 75 or 80 and can't quite produce the sound, I remember going to Carnegie Hall when Misha Elman played his last recital. He really almost could not vibrate. But just to see him on the stage holding that instrument with that chin like that, I went, oh my God. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. The commitment. And I was a youngster at the time, a commitment to see that. But then I know a lot of people that were like that. I'm very fortunate. I played with them. I became their friends. I could ask questions. They would ask me questions about this or that and the other. And that's what we have to do. We have to open up the educational system with not being extremely hesitant about talking about feelings. And right now, I can tell you the world is in a terrible place. I don't have to explain that. That's obvious. But how do we stop it? How do we make people feel better, even within this commotion that's going on? It's horrible. Will we always have dictators? Absolutely. Will we have homeless people? Absolutely. How do we fix that? I don't see that happening yet.
No.
But when I can go and play for the homeless in the street, I open my window and I see the homeless. I play for them. They go, hey, man, that's good. I made them feel for 20 seconds better. That's all. So let's try and find a way between all of us, maybe through technology, it could come, because it's very, people don't like it because they're isolated. So during COVID, the kids were all the time with the speakers. I mean, they were
headphones,
with a sound enhancement in the ears, and they absolutely by themselves. Sometimes you need to be by yourself, you know.
But the consequences of all this you see now coming up, you know, after years, what it has done, the damage that has been done to the kids, the social isolation, the, you know, preference of using their devices instead of really meeting in person. And it's dreadful.
But that's brand new still.
Yeah.
I think they did the same thing with the radio when it first came
out. But they would sit together around the radio and do other stuff.
Some,
you know?
Not
they would
all.
Dance to it. And
some could afford the radio.
Yeah.
My first radio, I was 9 years old.
You were still in Israel.
Two buttons in Israel, two buttons, and I couldn't get any reception. So I went and got some wire, and I put it onto one of the
like
screws.
An antenna.
And what I heard was, BBC. I was unbelievable, but I loved it.
Of course.
All of a sudden, I heard all this stuff from everywhere. A tiny bit of sound of music, but who the hell knew what the music? So that was my first radio, and I never forget. My first transistor, nevertheless, I could get a whole bunch of things. And when I saw Sputnik...
Still in Israel? Or
yeah, in Israel. In this first Sputnik I saw in 1956, over the sky, in Cholon, where I lived. I saw Sputnik going across. I went, one day I'm going to go up there. Cool. That's all I wanted to do, is go up at Sputnik.
Fantastic.
In 1956, it was the first one. So I'll never forget that moment.
That was the one with the Leica dog on board? Or
That was too far.
No, you can't.
It was just for my... It was way up there. But it went over the space, Israeli space, whatever it was. But it was way up there in 56. And I went, whoa. And we talked about it forever. Did you see that? It was like a star moving, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, well, of course, today, you know, will we ever get to Mars? Or maybe before that, live on the moon? Probably, probably. I won't be here. But I do want to play once in, with total weightless, just to see how it feels. You know, just with the bow.
In weightlessness?
Just to see, well, with the bow.
How the bow is going to work.
The bow, what happens with the bow.
That's interesting, because the weight is defined differently then.
Well, we don't really think of it.
Yeah.
We do when we teach, but how that feels when you start to play. Some people think I'm crazy. Well, okay, fine. But I just, literally maybe 1 minute just to
and
play a little bit.
What element will transport the sound then? If then there's no air.
I'm not an engineer, but just, no, because they'll have to transport it. It has to be obviously in space.
Yeah.
But I would love to be able to do. I have tried to play on an aeroplane to warm up before a rehearsal. You can't hear anything.
You know the Stockhausen for four helicopters?
Yes.
This is a brilliant piece. And the musicians have so much fun. You know, they sit in their little
Well, we're looking.
And
we're always looking. Yeah. I still like to go to Italy. When I was just in Italy just last week, 10 days ago. And every time I was up in the north also, I was in Padua, when I opened the violin case years ago, I open the violin case and I look at her and I go, welcome home. And I pick it up and it sounds different. Now, people say you're nuts, but I'm telling you, it sounds different. And I don't know why, but especially this time of the year, sort of February, early March, there's a mist. There's a kind of, not a rain, but it's a lot of drops, but it's a mist in the air. You can just see
it. Humidity or something.
They say it's fog. Well, maybe. But there's something about the violin, just, I don't put it outside. I open the window a little bit and I say, welcome home. And then I pick it up and I just tune. I go, whoa, that sounds good.
You were talking about her as being a feminine
always.
Entity.
Always.
Does she have a name?
Devil.
Devil.
She's called, because, you know, when they did L'Histoire of Stravinsky, the first time they used a woman as a devil, I said, are you serious? Well, think about it. I went, oops. I didn't say anything after that. It was wonderful to hear that voice as a devil. A great actress in Chicago. I'll never forget it. She was wearing red gloves, big long gloves.
Long gloves.
Oh! And then when I heard it with the male again, I go, eh, geschloffen, I would say. And it was really amazing. Well, Samuel Dushkin owned this violin for 50 years, a little, maybe after. I met my instrument.
Tell
when
me
I
about
was,
Samuel Dushkin.
He was a wonderful Russian Jew that came to America. He did a lot of transcriptions of Stravinsky. He worked with Stravinsky. The violin concerto was written for him.
Oh, cool.
He was a wonderful guy. Wonderful. Sam was a wonderful musician. And we went to shop, and he had the violin there. Wurlitzer, it was called. Nothing to do with the harpsichord. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The organ. And there were a few fiddle players in the room, and finally said, come on, Pinky, play something. I was 16, and when I picked it up, I just played the open G string. It was like somebody put a microphone inside the instrument. And everybody looked at me, what did you do? I said, I have no idea. But I played some more, and they went, wow, that's good. And I looked at Sam, and I said, you know, if you ever think of one day, if you ever think of maybe letting go of this instrument, please call me. Well, the story goes on. For many years, I had a few Guarneris, blah, 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 bought, sold. And in 1980, Mrs. Dushkin decided to sell it. So, of course, I immediately said, yes, 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 yes.
Me.
It was the same string, same bridge, same everything. And I was in London. Charles Beer came, brought it back. within 5 minutes. That's it. And I bought, with the help of a friend, I had some money. It was a lot of money at the time. Today, of course, it's totally ridiculous.
Unpayable.
And I've been playing on it since 1980, and it's really been an extraordinary friend.
And this is your one violin?
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly enough, the viola I have, which I also bought in London, the back and the sides are Andrea Guarneri. That's the grandfather of my fiddle. And the top is Filius. That's the father of my violin. So when people ask me...
Did the Filius redo some parts of it, or did they do this together?
Nobody knows. It's hard to know. They had the whole store, you know, they had a whole
building.
Unfortunately, we lost so much in the fire. But I think that when the people say to me, what do you play? I said, I don't play. I travel with the Guarneri family, and they love pizza. Nah, it's lucky. It's just also the Andrea sounds amazing. It's very similar... I've seen it on the inside. I think Del Gesù, when he came back to Cremona in 1738, 39, he looked at his grandfather's work, for sure. Because he can see how the arching takes place. And it's just, he knew that his grandfather was a genius. He was, I think that family, in many ways, not to take anything away from anyone else, especially Stradivari.
Of course.
They were acoustical geniuses because they created also windows for churches. And they had tables and things. That's not so easy to do in those days because it would make a lot of noise if the window wasn't right.
Sure.
Can you imagine that?
Like here sometimes.
Yeah. All the new,
hisses
exactly.
And all kinds of
so sounds. How come it doesn't do that? It fits perfectly. So there's an acoustical mind at work here. But today we have different things to do and different ways to do it and much faster. And also the wood, as it lives longer, it applies, it gives, you get more, well, moist in a way, like what I do when I go to Italy. Maybe it's my own subconscious.
I was wondering, does the viola respond the same way to Padua as your violin does?
Absolutely. It's exactly the same sound, almost.
So if you would record, probably you would do it there because the sound is like pristine.
Oh, well, record, I don't know. It's fakery anyway. So record, you only can go to a maximum of so many decibels, so what's the point? You know, well, we do it anyway because we leave something behind us because people want to hear it. Okay, fine. But don't forget to come to the concert hall.
So true.
Especially today.
So true.
And the world has changed. It definitely has changed. And it's changing more and more every week. And we need to really put together some great minds, I hope, sooner or later, from different vocations, different parts of the world. Go up to Mongolia and find a few people that can tell you a few secrets. There's nothing wrong with that. Go to Africa and go to those tribes and listen to that music. Go to the jungle and hear those animals cry in the morning because they're hungry. You know, and you better watch it. If you don't know what you're doing, you better not go out there by yourself. So these are all human elements. There's nothing wrong with that. I think one should do that if one can. I tell my kids always to go and listen to an Italian opera. Not necessarily in the place you live, but in Italy, because it's different. The language is different. The whole
feeling. The response is different.
The whole feeling of the 7th of December in the Scala. It's like opening up the sky, you know? I mean, that's the most amazing moment for opera in the world. That hall, that building is amazing and what it holds in it. And when you go outside, you see Verdi. Oh, yes. Yeah, you see Mozart in Salzburg, of course. But those are important things. You also smell different elements that really, I think, for me, in some way, relate to some of the music we hear from that country. Don't ask me why. I just am crazy, okay? Just call me crazy. But when some of the students we have had go and do that, if they're lucky enough, they come back and they tell me, you know what, you were right. Because we played Debussy a little differently now.
Oh.
It's very interesting. When I first came to
playing
Germany...
Playing Debussy differently when they were in Paris or playing differently when they were in Italy?
No. What I mean is if they come from America,
oh, okay.
They go to France, for example.
Sure. Sure.
And they hear French orchestra.
Sure.
Also the language. Not that I'm an expert in the language, but it's different. It's a totally different tonality. And that comes from the music. Like we know that from singing. All those incredible people that sing in German, it's different from English, and English is different from...
Absolutely, obviously. Absolutely.
Well, people don't relate to that necessarily when they're 20, 22. But it's important to do that. I remember talking to Jesse Norman once. I said, Jesse, how do you sing a German song? She says, I go to the dictionary and I look at every word and see what it means, first of all. Just the dictionary, what it means, not in the actual sentence. And then I try to imitate what I heard from somebody speaking the language. And I use my vocal cords according to what I heard from the person. And that's how I learned every new...
More diligence, yeah.
It's amazing. Now, if we could do that on the instrument, I try to a little bit. Because I do like the smell of the croissant at 7 in the morning on the Champs-Élysées with a good little coffee. That's amazing. It ain't Starbucks.
No.
No. And it's not. And that does something to the music. Fauré will be different, you know, not only Debussy. And the same thing when I saw the Danube for the first time in Prague, I thought I saw Mpapa, the water going Mpapa, Mpapa.
But there's no Danube in Prague. This same river is in Prague, the Moldau.
Yeah, the Moldau.
Yeah.
But when I saw it, I thought it was one, two, it was Budapest, I'm sorry. One, yeah. Two, three, one, two, three. I saw the water
dancing in the wind.
In
yeah.
Three, you know, cha-cha. Yeah, a little bit sugar, but the hell.
No, you're totally right. Like, if you ride on a camel, you understand all the Arab rhythms. Ah, this is a different time signature.
If you can stay up on a two hump, if you can stay up, not fall down the first time, you're lucky.
Yeah. One thing, because I think you have to go downstairs now, pretty much. Seeing you conduct is a delight in a way, because it feels as if you were giving a masterclass to the orchestra rather than conducting in an maestro old-fashioned way with the baton and everything. You keep interacting with the musicians quite differently, and your movements are very unorthodox in a way. And I feel the way they respond to you, the ambience the orchestra has with you is quite unusual for the relationship between a conductor and an orchestra.
There are certain points, and I won't go into it, but I was very lucky, very, very fortunate to have a very fine person at Juilliard, assistant. His name was John Nelson. He's still alive, and he's a very good conductor. And he's doing a lot of work in Germany as well on the choral music, which he loves. He's 80-something. Mm-hmm. And he taught us that it's very important to learn how to beat the time. Not time according to, you know, 75 to the quarter.
Metronome, yeah.
But just one, and don't change. A car doesn't change unless you want it to. So you got to try learning how to do that. And he started teaching us all that. Subdivisions. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's one part. Then when I started to play, I played with some extraordinary conductors. Obviously, Daniel was a huge influence, not only in the conducting aspect, but also as a musician. Well, to me, there's still one of the greatest talents, if ever there was someone else, I want to know who it is Zubin. Zubin was born to be in the podium. Don't ask me why, but he was born to be there. And he is, even now, in some ways, more tolerant in his being because he doesn't quite have the freedom. He has to sit. Mm-hmm. But my God, those arms are amazing. And the look, he gives you those Indian eyes and, oh my God. But it's so perfect. It really is. It's like one of the great, great airplanes that flies without any interruption. It's amazing. And he can do it slow. He can do it fast. He sometimes won't beat at all. So that's my education. Plus Kubelik. Then comes Giulini. And all these people. These are icons that I played with. And, of course, I watched many other people. What I learned in Cherbadake, of course. Cherbadake was maybe the greatest genius, philosopher of music, which I had the fortune to know. And to sit with him sometimes at lunch and talk about scores and music in general. He was a bit difficult, but that's okay, you know, because he didn't like any violinist.
Oh.
Oh, no. nah. And he told you so. You know, I would say names and say, nah, no, no. In certain ones, I don't know, Meshuggah. But it's okay, you know. Not everybody likes Mercedes-Benz, you know.
Sure.
Or Rolls Royce.
Not liking violins and then conducting orchestras is a bit difficult.
I was to say to him, but Heifetz is the king. He said he's not even a waiter. I said, okay, you know, no argument. It's okay, it's okay. But, you know, those are aspects of learning. This is not a criticism on him or anybody else. And so I was very fortunate to be able to do that. And when I played not as well as I thought I could, first of all, I didn't like it, but my friends would say, you know, that doesn't sound so good. You better fix it. That's fine. That's all good. There's nothing wrong with saying properly to someone, hey, no,
sure,
calm down, you know? So over the years, you develop a kind of vocabulary, self-examining vocabulary, which you don't have to talk about. You can just look at somebody and go, uh-oh. You know, if I look at a student badly or in some way, I go, they go, oh, I'm sorry. They just say, I'm sorry.
I understand.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
That's a human trait. It's great. Nothing to say, I'm sorry. Okay. I can talk about this for hours and hours and hours. I have really worked very hard and keep working very hard on how to help someone feel good when it sounds good. And that's so important. I don't care if it's quartet, octet, sextet, if it's an orchestra. The conducting, per se, there are certain elements, not to get very boring, because it's a boring subject, because there's no sound. There is sound inside. Oh, my God, yeah. I'm looking at you. What do you think that is? Can you explain that?
Expectation.
Okay, that's good. Expectation is good. Now, how do you get, as Zubin always says, 160 eyes to have the same expectation? Oh, yo, 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 yo. Okay, that's hard. Now, that's not a practice with just doing it, but inside your brain. You have to see someone in the fifth stand, sixth stand, and go, you don't say it, but you just do something, and bingo. Because today, we can't say the names of people.
No.
Frau Piccolo, bitte sehr. Das Klang von die Flöte... Gesellschaft ist ein bisschen nicht ganz ruhig. So they fix it. You just have to say it in a nice way. Fine. And in Vienna, of course, jeder eine ist ein Professor. Oh, mein Gott. Okay, fine. Okay, Professor. I don't want to be called Professor. I have a name. My mother and father gave me a name. Call me that. Okay? So there are ways of doing it. You have to mark your parts. I am from the school with the orchestral part and mainly... the string section. Why? Because it's the biggest body of people.
Sure.
So I bring my own parts, and I have over 500 of my own markings in my library, music library, which is now in PDF, thank God. So
physical and, scores.
Yeah, well, not the score. The score I do myself. Yeah. That's we decipher the score, mm-hmm. 4, 8, 12, 16, and so on. But, and some of the markings, but some people just mark the score, like Mahler. Mahler, Bach, Lenny, only there. So Bruno Walter, in the score. To me, the score is the Heilige Bibel. I don't touch that. Even when I play, I don't mark that much in my violin part, very little. I started doing a little bit in the last 10 years because sometimes my eyes cross a little bit. It's tired, so I put an appo somewhere. It helps my coordination. Again, it's a learning process. But the actual physical conducting is a question of three things. One, the ability of the orchestra to understand the upbeat, not the downbeat, the upbeat. The downbeat is your problem. So is the upbeat, by the way. But the downbeat, if you put it slow and you go fast, whoopsala. Okay, that's a bad example. But you need to really learn that up and down is the same. Oh, Celli was so, he was so right about that because of gravity. That's all. And he called the beginning a point of departure. Why is it departure? And I go, departure? Well, let's see. Are we going on a journey? He said, good. Because a symphony is a journey. Life is a journey. The beat is a journey. But you have to do it properly. Okay. And not to get too basic, But that's very important. And then you have to go to the side. Now you can do it with an angle or you can just go straight, depending on the music. But you learn to do that. In time, it becomes part of your whole function. But if you give a downbeat here in the middle, and then you give the second beat way over on the south side of the city, oh my God, get out of here. No, and the musicians go, what the hell is that? Okay. Musicians will look at someone, as Celi said, when they come out on the stage, rehearsal or concert. And they will look at how you get on the podium, if you have a podium. I stopped using the podium for smaller orchestras. You don't really need it. I'm tall enough so they can see it.
Yeah.
I now do gestures, circular gestures, a little bit more than I used to in front. So people say, don't do that. As a conducting student, you're not supposed to go eins and then noch einmal eins with a circle. Why not? Well, because it's not good. Okay. So you go one and then to the side. Fine. And then to the other side, and then back up again and down again. Yes, correct. That's how we drive the car. But sometimes you drive the car with the left hand, sometimes you drive with the right hand. Don't conduct with the left hand. The left hand is for feeling, crescendo, diminuendo. I had to learn to do that. And I taught myself by being ambidextrous, by picking up the phone, by with turning the knob on a, opening up the window, etc. So now I can actually do this and beat time. You want three? Okay. But this stays the same, as you can tell, right?
Yeah.
On my hair. Okay. It takes time. It's practice.
Independence and...
Independence of the hand. Yeah. This motion of inviting somebody to play, you learn to do that with time. An orchestra doesn't really like somebody pointing at them. What the hell do you want to point at? You.
Your turn.
But some people in the old days would point.
Sure.
Musicians got used to it. You hear Toscanini tapes and you go, my God, what the hell is he saying? You know? But that's an old time. You also used to scream at children a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we've changed a little bit. That's come into some of our idiosyncrasies in language. Thank you so much for sending me that email. It's dead. What are you thinking of the person? Call them up. No, we don't call anymore. We just send messages. I actually still call. Not that I don't like the messages, but I like to hear the person's reply.
You are really a verbal person. Yeah, it's wonderful.
I can't help it. I come from a different generation.
Yeah.
The conductee somehow becomes more of a natural extension of how you're feeling in the time of your development, let's say. And I still think that I'm developing to some extent in the field of both playing, understanding what I'm doing, playing-wise, and the same applies to the conducting. So I'm amazed sometimes when I pick up a piece that I haven't done, a symphony, let's say in 10 years, how more aware I am of the mistakes I made 10 years ago.
You remember those?
It's not remembrance. It's really an annoyance.
Oh, okay.
It's like somebody is slapping me. He says, what the hell were you doing
that's
10 years ago? So, but that's good. That's real. Also because when I was in Ottawa, we had a program for 4 weeks of teaching all the instruments in the orchestra, but also conducting. And I realized with two people that were teaching conducting that one spoke very little and one spoke all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So which is better? I don't know. But they also recorded everything. There was every recording for a young conductor. So when somebody obviously did a piano with huge gestures, I'd scream. I don't want to do it now in front of the microphone. But I said, what? I said, don't look at the score. What's the dynamic? You don't know the dynamic and you want the orchestra to follow you? Shame on you. You go home and you better look at that score. So, of course, they look and say, oh, I'm sorry. You should be. They'll never do it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of teaching that is not allowed anymore sometimes. But I do that also with playing. I said, Brahms did not write that. They said, oh, you're right. whoops. And Beethoven definitely didn't write that. So why are you doing it? Now, the nuances that you bring forward, like, but essentially, and not to get too deep into this discussion, you have five dynamics: pianissimo, piano, mezzo forte, forte, and fortissimo. Basta. Everything else, like three pianos and four pianos, or three fortes and three, or four fortes, to me, that's a color. That's a color. So let's go back to the five dynamics. I do that sometimes now. I have been doing it for quite a few years, where I ask the orchestra to play me four beats, like that, three, four, slow bow, piano. And when I see somebody playing with the bow too fast, I go, again. I go, Eventually they go, hey, bravo. Okay, it takes three times, believe it or not. And it's piano. I said, piano, 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 piano. And everybody plays piano, and they're listening to each other. I said, it's not in tune. Let's tune the instruments. And I start with the G now. Anyway, you learn these things as conductor. That will eventually also come into your physical being. And when you hear great annotators, i.e. great actors, they will tell you that the first thing they do when they sit in a theater situation or for the movies with a score, with a part, with a script, they sit down and listen. That's phenomenal. I don't know how many, I've had wonderful friends that are great, great, great actors, and that's the first thing they do, is they listen. The other thing they told me, the great comedians, and which taught me a lot also, is in order to have drama, you have to have laughter, but it also work the other way. When you have laughter, it's so easy to get drama. Okay, that's good.
So we come back to where we started in a way.
In a way, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the understanding of listening is a process of growing up, having the luck to play, and in my case, to also conduct wonderful ensembles, wonderful friends, but never forget what I was told by Zubin, 160 eyes are looking at you. That's what Celibidache said. He didn't say 160 eyes. So when you get up on a podium, say good morning. And if it's good after, if it's afternoon, you've just seen them, say good afternoon. They may not even look at you, but just say good afternoon. And they, by the way, I'd like to start with a slow movement. I know you have it already, but I'd like to start with a slow movement of the Tchaikovsky Symphony. What's wrong with saying that? So, of course, young guys will say, by the way, they have all that written up. I said, I don't care. That's an administrator. You're an administrator now? So go back to the office, you know? You're talking about people here. And the orchestra actually responds in a warm way. Some of them don't necessarily listen, but they don't tell you that it's wrong. I've yet to hear any of my buddies that have been sitting in orchestras for years say, Pink, that's ridiculous. What the hell are you talking about? They're not one of them says that. So I work on that a lot. When you're playing chamber music with professionals, meaning good friends, there are ways of speaking that should be applied. Sometimes it's not, especially with quartets. We've heard terrible stories. Well, they live with each other all the time. So, but when you had a couple of friends that I've had where they say, would you mind trying that this way? This is after 25, 30 years of playing with each other. Would you mind trying it that way? I go, wow, that's amazing. You still talk like that to each other? So you start using it with your kids, with your wife, with your friends. Would you mind explaining that again? Sorry, I didn't hear the directions. Could you give me that fingering again? Could you give me the directions again? What's wrong with that? Now, we don't do that all the time, obviously. But most of the time, if we can start thinking a little bit that way, particularly when you're showing a young person the ways of the future for themselves, don't get in front of the orchestra and start tuning. Wait till they all tune, you know? And then say, could I please have an A? Or tune with them and just, or tune backstage, don't tune on stage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, really? I said, yeah. You know why? Because the A is different backstage for you. So just tune like that. And when they tell you it's too high or it's too low, fix it. That's number one. Number two, you're not wasting any time. Time is money, you know? So they begin to learn this discipline. And we learned that right away. Galamian told us right away not to tune when we practiced. Because before we had these new dominant strings, we had gut strings, and they would go out of tune. So you'd play the end of the movement with a cadenza, with open A and Ds, they were so out of tune.
Yeah.
And you always saw solos turn around in the tutti before the cadenza. You know? So we don't do that anymore. You don't have
to. That's not necessary, yeah.
That's lucky. So, but still, don't tune. Just get used to adjusting. It's everything is really an adjustment. Until you say to somebody, can you please adjust to me? That's when you have to quit.
I could talk to you forever, but I just have to make sure you have 20 minutes to the show, and I think you have
to get
your little... Your
nah, I put my schmatte on, you know.
Fantastic.
Okay. Well, this is a long time. My God.
Yeah.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.